Opioid drugs used properly have helped millions deal with severe pain. But the powerful prescription medications are easy to become addicted to and can lead otherwise law-abiding citizens to desperate measures such as heroin once they can no longer access legal drugs. Why have so many Americans become hooked on these medications, and why is it so hard to get free of opioid addiction? An upcoming Alaska Wellness Summit will look for ways to conquer the opioid crisis, and we're discussing it today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media comes from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Hydrocodone, oxycodone, OxyContin, Vicodin. There are myriad other commercial names for a potent class of narcotics that can effectively block pain, but can also cause more trouble than good for people who abuse and become addicted to them. The CDC calls it an epidemic. The problem is enormous and impacts all sectors of society. Addiction doesn't discriminate. How has this happened, and what's the best approach for helping those who are struggling in the grips of opioid abuse? We've got the state's top doctors in the studio to help us better understand the scope of this problem, and we'll be joined by the nation's top doctor, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy, at the bottom of the hour. Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's Chief Medical Officer. Welcome, Dr. Butler.
Good morning. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. And also in the studio today is Dr. Shane Coleman. Dr. Coleman is a doctor of psychiatry and works as the Medical Division Director for South Central Foundation.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being with us. A wellness summit is taking place in Palmer on Thursday. The Surgeon General will be in Alaska for the summit, as well as top officials with the Veterans Administration, Health and Human Services, and top and state officials. Dr. Butler, clearly this is an urgent national issue. Please give us some state context. How big is the problem of addiction to opioids in Alaska?
Well, let me start by saying I agree with the CDC in using the term epidemic to describe the situation with opioids. I don't actually use the term epidemic very often, but it's very unusual that we have a single cause of death that increases fourfold over a period of roughly a decade. So this has really gotten public health's attention and I think begin a dialogue about the broader context of how we address addictions across the board, both in terms of individual patient and client services and as a population health issue. In Alaska, we began to see increases in overdose deaths from prescription opioids a little more than 10 years ago. And that increase came down slightly around 2010, 2011, and then has been pretty steady ever since. At the same time, the number of overdose deaths from heroin has increased. And in 2015, more than 80 of our fellow Alaskans died of opioid overdose. Roughly three dozen had heroin on board at the time of death. But I think it's important to recognize that more than half of those who died with heroin in their systems also had prescription opioids on board. So sometimes we think of sort of a graduation from prescription opioids to heroin. And I think in some ways they become interchangeable because the prescription opioids can be expensive, they can be hard to get, the newer abuse deterrent formulations can be harder to self-administer, whereas at the same time the price of heroin has come down, it's easy to obtain, it's easier to prepare for administration. and it's available.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing today opioid addiction, the very serious problem in our state and our nation. And we're also discussing an upcoming Alaska Wellness Summit. You can join our conversation if you have a story of recovery or struggle to share, if you're concerned just generally, or you have family members or friends, loved ones that you're concerned about. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255 or 8478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Are these drugs, these opioid drugs, more addictive than other drugs? And if so, why?
Well, I think the question of relative addictiveness is fairly nuanced. But let's talk a little bit about what addiction is. I mean, broadly, addiction is compulsive drug seeking and use regardless of the harmful consequences. That's a functional definition, and you know, we see that in medical practice every day. Certainly people in the community see it, and that explains why some behaviors that otherwise are sort of inexplicable occur among people who are struggling with addiction. The cry of a baby may no longer have that top importance compared to the drive to achieve the next dose of the medication. It's important when we talk about opioids, though, to distinguish between dependency and addiction. Mm. Dependency is the physical requirement for the drug, and it's related to tolerance. And basically, anyone, if they take opioids over a period of weeks to months, will become dependent and experience tolerance. And that can lead to withdrawal symptoms, sometimes called dope sickness. And that can be very unpleasant. And those can certainly drive use. But it's important to distinguish that from the effects of addiction. And the emerging neurobiology has helped us to understand that distinction better, in that the brain essentially becomes hardwired to the effects of the drug. And that is what leads to addiction and the reordering of priorities within the brain and the thought processes, and that then drives drug seeking and drug use. It's important to recognize while dependency is the inevitable outcome of prolonged exposure to opioids, addiction is not inevitable. There's certainly some genetic factors, there are some risk factors involved, but not everyone who uses opioids, even recreationally, will become addicted. And not everyone who becomes addicted to prescription opioids will progress to heroin use. So we're talking about gradations. But having said that, it's important to recognize that one of the biggest risk factors for heroin addiction is having used prescription painkillers recreationally. Today, about 80% of people who use heroin report they started using opioids with prescription painkillers. Among people who use prescription painkillers recreationally, there's a 40-fold higher chance of going on to using heroin than among people who don't use it at all. And that's not just a reflection of risk-taking behavior. Increased risk is only about 1.5 to 2 times higher among people who drink to excess, and only about 3 times higher among people who use marijuana. So it's not just a matter of people who use some drugs are more likely to use other drugs, but there's also a link that is specifically related to opioids.
Dr. Coleman, let's get you in here now. Dr. Butler was talking about the hardwiring that happens in the brain. Does opioid addiction impact someone's brain differently than other types of addiction?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's hard to say if it really impacts the brain differently. I think there's a lot of commonalities among addictions and different substances, though it's pretty clear that it impacts the brain really significantly. I mean, there's all sorts of kind of interesting animal models, for instance, where, you know, under the right circumstances, mice or something similar will be exposed to some sort of heroin or cocaine or in a medication or a substance like that. And you can watch kind of the priorities that Jay mentioned shift, and they will go and stimulate that, for instance, over water, over food, over many things, which is, you know, it kind of speaks to that rewiring biologically of the brain. And I'm really glad you made that distinction between addiction, basically, and dependence. You know, when people come into my office, it's definitely the addiction part that, you know, they feel out of control. They recognize that these priorities have been rewired, and, you know, they want to be better parents. They want to have work. They want to, you know, they want to be functional in their life. And that's really what gets in the way, is the addiction part of it.
Can these drugs permanently alter your brain or the chemistry that's going on in your brain system?
Yeah, I think most people would suggest that they do. Even after somebody's in recovery and stable in recovery, you know, it can take quite a few months and even years for people to kind of fully navigate that process. And a lot of that, I think, is the brain rewiring itself after a long, you know, long period of addiction or drug use.
Is it the same for all types of addiction? Is that recovery process similar, or is it different somehow with these more powerful class of drugs?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I think it's individualistic, you know, by patient kind of sort of, or according to someone's journey through recovery of sorts. There's a lot of, I would say there's more commonalities than differences, but I think that opiates and heroin definitely have, you know, there's a real draw there. There's an intense addiction that occurs with them, sometimes a little bit different than other substances.
How do opioid drugs, especially the prescription medications that are out there, how do they work? What's going on with how these work so effectively and then end up leading to this dependence? Let's start with the dependence aspect of it. How do they work in your system, and how does that lead to the dependence?
Well, the opioids bind to specific receptors within the brain that the mu receptors are just one type, but probably the most important type. And that leads to not only the relief of pain, which occurs both centrally and peripherally, outside of the brain, that is, but also leads to a release of neurotransmitters in the brain that flow to the part of the brain known as the nucleus accumbens. It's got a better name. Some people call it the pleasure center of the brain, which is a much more memorable name and much more interesting, too. But this is what leads to the feelings of pleasure that can be associated with use of opioids. Now, it's important to remember, not everyone experiences that same experience. It's somewhat of a minority, but I've certainly had patients that find opioids very unpleasant, that it's more of a dysphoric experience. The nausea that may come with it will outweigh any relief of pain or even any feelings of pleasure that come with that. So in that sense, you know, that's a role of the opioids that is fairly specific in terms of how they affect the brain. That release of neurotransmitters is part of what then can lead to behaviors that ultimately can lead to addiction. And in fact, it's even been said that addiction is essentially a learning disorder, because part of the brain is really conditioned to the drug and even the drug-seeking behaviors. So part of recovery may involve avoiding certain circumstances that sort of stimulate those same parts of the brain, as well as controlling access to the drug and limiting or eliminating use of the drug altogether.
Is there a way to sort of parse out? You were talking about how some people don't find any pleasure in taking these drugs, that it's actually unsettling or not a good experience for them. Is there a way to sort of parse out who those people are compared to the people who find these drugs pleasurable and then end up in trouble with them? Are the people who don't enjoy that experience more likely to be living sober, completely sober lifestyles? Or Is there a way to sort of parse out the different personalities involved here, Dr. Coleman? You're
nodding. I think the answer is we wish. I mean, we wish we could have a little test or give us a drop of blood and we could let you know kind of truly what your risk is of experiencing the medication in a certain way. There are risk factors. You know, people, I think it is people who already use or misuse substances are going to be at higher risk. Certainly things like trauma, both kind of psychological and physical pain can sometimes put people in a situation where they might be more likely. So there's, you know, there's kind of soft risk factors, if you will, but certainly nobody is good and can tell you right from the beginning, oh, yes, this person may have a problem and this person will not.
Yes, that's Dr. Coleman's Nobel Prize someday when he has the answer to that question.
Exactly.
All right, we'll be looking forward to that. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Thomas is in Anchorage. Hi, Thomas.
Hi there. Thank you, Lori, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to start out quickly. I've been studying this thing for decades on proposed drug laws in general, and I'll start with a rhetorical question of how did the world get along for thousands and thousands of years without any drug laws? Okay, that's said. Where did our drug laws come from? Well, after the American Civil War, the abolitionists found themselves unemployed, effectively, and they looked around and they saw this population of veterans, many of whom were suffering from what they called the soldier's disease, that is morphine addiction, and they were living really pathetic lives. And these folks decided, with the highest sense of decency, to try to save people from themselves by taking their vices away from them. Prostitution, gambling, drugs, alcohol, the whole list. But they never imagined that anybody be punished. This wasn't a punitive thing. This was a, we're going to help you, social do-gooder kind of thing. Sadly, by the turn of the century, Jim Crow attitudes, hatred, and oppression of minorities and bohemians and anybody that was different got into the act. And in the first laws, they added criminal penalties. Our war on drugs has grown out of this. Now, the drugs themselves are incredibly cheap. They grow in a lot of places. They're easy to process. And the pharmaceutical industry is making a fortune. So what I'm wondering is whether total legalization and sale only to adults in sealed capsules, containers, that can only be legally opened at home with the person's name on it, that a druggist, a pharmacist, a chemist, an apothecary could require a person to know something about dosage of the particular thing they want to buy before the pharmacist chooses to sell it to them. Hmm. But the total legalization won't solve all of society's ills, but would allow a medicalization of the problem as opposed to a criminal justice department. And that's the heart of my argument.
Well, thank you, Thomas. Very interesting line of discussion and consideration here. It sort of reminds me of a conversation I had with someone about gambling addiction years ago. And this gentleman suggested that there is a certain percentage of society that's addictive. And he said that's about 10 to 12%. It doesn't seem to go up or down a whole lot from that. So kind of combining that with what Thomas has suggested here is just legalizing, making it a medical issue, and then dealing responsibly with those who struggle. What are your thoughts? We've got two medical professionals right here. What would you say to an idea such as that?
Well, let me begin by saying
Thomas describes
very accurately some of the historical context that brought us to where we're at today. I sometimes describe the situation that has led to where we're at with opioids as a road to hell that was paved with good intentions. Mm. He touched on some of the 19th century emergence of morphine as an addictive drug, and fans of Arthur Conan Doyle probably have read in, I think it was Sign of Four, about Sherlock Holmes had his syringe and needle in a neat Moroccan case, and, you know, it was, what is it today, morphine or cocaine?
Mm-hmm.
And that common use of opioids and then the recognition of the challenge of addiction led to new measures, one of which was by Bayer Pharmaceuticals to develop what they thought was going to be an addiction-resistant opioid, which they named after the German word for hero, and it's what we know as heroin. And of course, it Yikes. Was not non-addictive. The law enforcement reaction that Thomas described also led to the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914, which essentially was prohibition on use of narcotics for the medical profession. And that loosened up slowly over the decades, but I think it did lay a foundation of undertreatment of pain by physicians through much of the 20th century, particularly the mid part of the decade. I think we're now at a point where we've probably swung too far the other direction. But in terms of the question of legalization, I think one point he made, which is very important, is the drugs that are bought on the street are of unknown quantity. Mm-hmm. They're of unknown concentration. And, you know, we can say let the buyer beware, but people are dying because they don't necessarily know what they are getting. And it's easy to sit back and say, well, that's a choice they're making. But one of the issues in the functional definition of addiction is choice has been lost.
Right.
And I won't argue that sometimes the pathway to addiction starts with some choices and sometimes some bad choices. But at some point in that journey, choice is lost. And the effects on the brain, which, as Dr. Coleman was describing, can be a chronic, ongoing brain condition, take that choice away. So it's a very provocative question. The scientific data on that is still emerging, but there are experiments and trials and pilots in various places, even doing things like controlled infusion of heroin as a way to manage heroin addiction. Hmm. So it's a point that's very well taken. I don't know quite where the sweet spot is in terms of that continuum between total commercialization and total prohibition for each substance, but in general, it's oftentimes going to be at some point between those two poles.
Dr. Coleman, please weigh in here on this and also the idea of percentages of the population. We're mm-hmm. seeing this explosion in opioid addiction, but as the caller suggested, is it just a transference from one addiction to another?
Yeah, I think Jay makes some good highlights. You know, I think there's pros and cons to any approach that you take, and I'm sure this is one of them. On the one hand, you know, you'd have the benefit maybe of scientifically being able to, you know, evaluate the constitution of the heroin or drug or something that somebody might use or purchase. On the other side, I worry about the exposure and the potential increase in exposure to the population in general. So not unlike the kind of fix that we've gotten ourselves into now, the more you expose folks, the more you expect that folks will become addicted to it of sorts. There are some, you know, there's some analogies to be made. Maybe I know that Washington in the last few years went from kind of state control to privatization of alcohol. And there's some public studies, public health studies there that show that generally speaking, public health outcomes, things like whether it's car accidents or other safety things in the general public, did feel the impact, and privatization because of the increased access, certain hours of the day, easier access to teens, things like that, that, you know, there's been arguments made that that was adversely affected public health. Although, you know, again, there's pros and cons and proponents for and against each of these situations and scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Leah is in Ketchikan. Hi, Leah. Did you have a question?
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to do a comment question to the team there. I come from a community where we live in an island where, you know, we have, you know, some of the public safety issues that are surrounding the topic of syringes. And right now our task force is exploring syringe drop boxes. Like there are some 4A programs that are spread through the state. So those are kind of some of the safety issues that we're having to deal with. There are some examples that happen in our community where youth, they clean their area within the school system, as a spring cleanup, and several of the teens had found syringes that were out in the open nearby some of the bushes and things like that. So that's definitely a public issue that we're dealing with. My question is regarding to long-term treatment in Alaska, and that's quite limited when we have opiate users are going into detox and they have to wait, you know, 3 to 6 months to get into a long-term facility. Mm. What are some of the things that providers can do when they, you know, when opiate users are signing this pain management contract in the meantime while they're waiting to go into treatment? What are some ways that providers or case managers can do to help the opiate users from, you know, getting back to, the risk of using, bad syringes or...
Right, before they go into treatment.
Before they go into treatment. What are some preventive or maybe some more of a management ways that we can look for in our community to help?
Dr. Coleman, how about if you jump in on this part of the conversation? Thank you, Leah.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm glad you brought it up. It's a big challenge. We certainly struggle with our treatment services here in the state and getting people in a timely manner. I'll give you some examples of how our system. So I work at South Central Foundation, and I think what we would say is we try to support treatment wherever we call our patients customer owners, wherever our customer owners are at. And so, you know, I think making as many mental health and addiction-related services available to folks as is possible is a good start. You know, we have, for instance, integrated master-level mental health clinicians into our primary care system. So if you were waiting for services, you could go to primary care and speak with somebody who knows something about opiate addiction, about mental health. We could actually start the treatment there, maybe while you were waiting. We have, you know, both mental health services as well as medication-assisted treatment options. And so I think that that's one strategy that we would use, is to try to make those services available to you while you're waiting. And I think other clinics can strive towards making those kinds of services available in their system as well. It's sometimes harder out in the rural areas because frequently, you know, they struggle to have the resources to man people in primary care and other clinics. But integration is one thing that we offer that helps bring those services to people who need it.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the problem of opioid addiction. And we are joined today in the studio by Dr. Jay Butler, the state's chief medical officer, and by Dr. Shane Coleman, a psychiatrist who is the division director for the South Central Foundation. We're going to be joined by U.S. Surgeon General Vice Admiral Dr. Vivek Murthy in just a few moments. Senator Dan Sullivan worked on pulling this wellness summit together that will be happening in Palmer on Thursday. I talked to him a few days ago about why he's gotten involved. The senator said he spoke with Alaskans who came to D.C. for a march against addiction, and their stories were really eye-opening for him. He said it was some of the most powerful stories that he's heard since taking office. Senator Sullivan is also on the Armed Services and Veterans Affairs Committee. He says the addiction crisis has greatly impacted military members.
And there was this concern that you had veterans, either, you know, returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq, or other veterans who are, you know, dealing with chronic pain from injuries, who were prescribed a lot of these opioids. And look, it's great that the senior veterans officials for the entire VA are going to be here, but there was some concern that our veterans were getting treated with these opioids in pill form, and what was happening was it was leading to addiction and then use of other drugs to maintain the addiction. That's kind of the story, and I'm sure the Surgeon General, who we're very honored to have come to Alaska, you know, I think he's going to tell that story as well. There was this kind of movement in the medical community throughout the country on the importance of treating pain, which it really, really is important. But there was a sense that you can do it without running the risk of addiction. Well, that turned out to be inaccurate. And unfortunately, there was this wave of prescription drugs that turned into addiction for all kinds of Americans. This is the other thing, Lori. It just this runs the gamut of every class, every social group, every age group. And people, when they were addicted, started turning not just to the pills, but to actual heroin. High school kids, right? Straight A students, star athletes, ending up being dead from overdoses.
Senator Dan Sullivan speaking about the problem of opioid addiction and why he got involved in the issue and helped put together this summit that's happening in Palmer on Thursday. Senator Sullivan says having the federal officials here is important so they can hear Alaska's story, and also they can then let Alaskans know what the federal government can do to help. We're going to be joined by the U.S. Surgeon General in just a moment. We're trying to get him on the phone right now. But back to you, Dr. Butler, kind of following up on this conversation that we were having before, I know that you wanted to add some comments before we went to Senator Sullivan's.
Right. Well, I think Leah raises some good points about and good questions about what about the individual who is still using or who is seeking treatment,
yes,
and not yet able to get into treatment? What can we do to help improve the health of those people? And there's a couple of things that I think are important. She mentioned syringe and needle exchange programs. You know, that's an area where there has been quite a bit of emergence of new data showing that that can decrease the complications of self-injection drug use, specifically transmission of HIV and hepatitis C. I think in the past 2 years, we've had quite a warning from Indiana, the small town of Austin, Indiana, a town with only about 4,000 residents, that over a six-month period had over 181 new cases of HIV infection, all associated with self-injection of the prescription opioid Opana. That is a phenomenal outbreak. That was actually more cases of self-injection related HIV than occurred in all of New York City during that year. That worries me because I think that could happen in Alaska if we don't address the challenge. So as the caller mentioned, 4A's has syringe and needle exchange programs in Anchorage and Juneau. The Interior AIDS Association has an exchange in Fairbanks. There is no data that suggests that syringe and needle exchange programs encourage or facilitate self-injection drug use. It seems to assume, again, that self-injection is each time is a rational choice. It's kind of ignoring the science suggesting that it is a condition of the brain that leads to that behavior. The other point I would want to make is that people who are actively using, they should have access to naloxone or Narcan. And not a good idea for radio, but I'm holding a ampule of spray naloxone. It looks about the size of a Lego man. You're the broadcast journalist, Lori. Perhaps you can describe it better.
An inch and a half tall or so.
Yeah, but it can be life-saving to someone who has overdosed.
We have the U.S. Surgeon General on the line with us now. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy joins us by phone from Seattle. Dr. Murthy will be in Alaska tomorrow. Sir, please give us some national perspective. Thank you so much for joining us. How serious is the opioid crisis compared to other public health concerns in the country? We've heard a lot about Zika and other things that make the news cycle, but give us some national perspective about this crisis, sir.
Well, I'm happy to, Lori, and it's good to be with you today. I'm so happy that you're talking about this issue with your listeners. The opioid crisis is a major public health crisis. It is one of the most important public health issues of our time. And I'll tell you why. It's because we've seen the number of overdose deaths from prescription opioids quadruple since 1999. We have nearly 2 million people who are addicted to prescription opioids. And we each and every day find more and more families who are impacted by this epidemic, either because they have lost a loved one or because they have friends or others they know who have been impacted by the epidemic. It's also costing us dearly in terms of healthcare costs and economic productivity. But the good news is that this is an epidemic that we can have a positive impact on if we do a few key things, and among those are changing how we prescribe pain medications and how we treat pain more generally, as well as ensuring that we are connecting people to treatment. Because right now we have over 2 million people who need treatment, but only about 1 million who can get it. We have to close that gap.
Dr. Murthy, there have been other drug abuse crises in our country going back several generations. Most recently, cocaine, crack cocaine, methamphetamine, a drug that people could make from over-the-counter ingredients. How does the opioid abuse problem compare to these other drugs, these other addictive substances?
Well, what's different and what's unusual about the prescription opioid crisis is that this is in part a crisis that came about, of our own making. It's about 20 years ago or so, doctors and nurses were urged to treat pain more aggressively without necessarily being given the training or the support to do so. That coincided with aggressive marketing of pain medications to doctors and very little public awareness about the fact that these medications were highly addictive. And I'll tell you that I remember being taught during my medical training, like many other doctors, that prescription painkillers were not addictive as long as you gave them to somebody with legitimate pain. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that that's not actually the case. But all of these factors came together to create a crisis that is now claiming over 40 lives a day. And it's also contributing to the use of heroin, which we have seen increase in Alaska, as well as in many other parts of the country. And the heroin crisis, in turn, is not only contributing to illness, healthcare costs, and to death, but we know that the prescription opioid crisis is also fueling the spread of hepatitis C and HIV. That's why it's so important that we come together to address this crisis right now.
Dr. Murthy, in the past, I think that a lot of people would say, excuse me, that drug abuse was seen as an urban problem, not a rural one. Crack, cocaine, and meth kind of changed that perspective. As you visit states, you're kind of on a tour right now talking to the country about this problem. As you visit states, are you finding that the problem is larger in urban or rural areas, or how would you parse that out?
Well, this is what is striking about the opioid crisis. The opioid crisis does not discriminate between urban and rural, between rich and poor, between people of color and white folks. This is affecting all communities, and I've seen this firsthand as I've traveled the country. One of the reasons I'm coming to Alaska is because I want to see myself how the crisis is impacting Alaska, but also understand what urban and rural communities are doing to address it. I'll be in Anchorage for part of my trip, but we'll also be spending some time in Bethel as well as in Neposkia, where I'll be trying to understand more closely what the communities are actually experiencing and share with them some lessons that we have learned from other communities about how we can make a dent in this epidemic.
The Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, signed by President Obama in July. Dr. Murthy, what does this new law provide in the fight against opioid abuse?
Well, the new law is important for several reasons. One is it's an important bipartisan statement about the importance of addressing this epidemic and doing so now. And it does lay the foundation for us to do critical things like expanding access to treatment and ensuring that we are prescribing these medicines properly. What we do need to do, though, in addition to the TARA bill, is ensure that we are also providing funding to support some of the changes which we know are important. For example, we know that setting up treatment centers takes resources, it takes money. We know that training clinicians and educating the public about how to prevent opioid use disorders also takes funds and investment. I think this is an investment that's very important. I think it's very worthwhile, and it will pay dividends for us in terms of healthcare dollars saved and lives saved, most importantly. It's important for us to make sure that we are also putting resources toward this effort in addition to passing legislation like the CARA bill. So my hope is that those funds and resources will follow soon after. But this is also, I want to be clear that this is an issue that people across the country from both parties have come together around, because it is affecting so many parts of our country, and this is not a a crisis that discriminates. And that's why, as part of our tour, in addition to visiting communities to talk directly to them about what we need to do to address the opioid crisis, I will also be, later this summer, sending a letter to 2.3 million healthcare providers, urging them to join the national movement that we are building to turn the tide on the opioid crisis. And I'll also be sending with that letter a pocket card that clinicians can keep in their white coats to help guide them in how to treat pain safely and effectively.
Well, I know that you have a busy schedule, sir. My last question, Dr. Murthy, is VA officials will also be here for the summit. We heard from Senator Dan Sullivan about this concern. What's known about the depth of the problem within the military and the veterans community, and how is that being addressed?
Well, this is a crisis that's certainly affecting our veterans communities as well. We know that many of our veterans, especially after they come back from combat, will suffer injuries and will have pain afterward. And they are certainly, in the context of getting pain medications, at risk of developing addiction. I want to be clear, this does not mean that we should not be giving prescription opioids to people who need them. There are folks who absolutely need those medications. We got to make sure they're getting them. But our goal is to make sure that we are prescribing in a way that's smart, so that we're getting the medications to people who need them and minimizing or not getting medications to people who are at greater risk of developing addiction. And the VA has made this issue a priority because they recognize that many of our veterans are impacted by this. And they see the same stories that I have seen as I have traveled across the country. I'll tell you, just recently I was in Arizona visiting a treatment facility there, and I met a young man who told me that he had begun using prescription pain medications when he was in high school, and he started using them just so he could feel a bit better and so he could fit in with the folks around him. And some years later, after going through dealing with his addiction for many years, he actually was diagnosed with testicular cancer, which fortunately they were able to treat. But then a couple of years later, he was told that he had a recurrence. Now, most people, if they had a recurrence of cancer, would be devastated, or at the very least, very sad. And his reaction was striking because he was elated. And he explained to me the reason he was happy was because he figured he would need a major surgery and would likely get another prescription for opioid medications. And he shared that with me to illustrate just how powerful addiction is in impacting your reasoning and your judgment. And that's why as I travel around the country, I'm not only seeking to work with clinicians to help them understand how to prescribe safely, not just working with policymakers and community members to expand access to treatment, but I'm also working with community members to change how we think about addiction, because we have to recognize that addiction is not a bad choice. It's not a character flaw. It is a disease of the brain, one that requires the same compassion and care that any other chronic disease requires.
Thank you so much, Dr. Murthy, for being with us this morning and for visiting Alaska. I understand you'll be here arriving probably tonight, speaking tomorrow at ANMC, Alaska Native Medical Center, and Thursday at Palmer. Thank you, sir, for being on with us today.
Absolutely. Glad to be with you. And thank you for making this issue a priority as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you. That was Vice Admiral U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy speaking to us. Dr. Murthy will be here in Alaska tomorrow. We want to go back to the phones in a moment, but Dr. Butler, we were talking about syringes. I've twice been out running with my dog and saw them just lying on the ground, needles intact. The public health dangers of these contaminated needles seems enormous. Have there been injuries or infections transmitted by discarded syringes?
Laurie, the evidence for transmission from discarded syringes and needles is fairly scant, but I think it's important to recognize that it is a very real risk. So, one of the additional advantages of the exchange programs is to have the needles and syringes managed in a safer manner. particularly so that they're not on playgrounds and places where particularly children may play with them. And it's, I hear this from roadside cleanup crews. I mean, people are finding needles and syringes everywhere. So I think the risk is very real. Of course, the greatest risk is when that needle and syringe is reused by someone to inject themselves. But accidental exposure certainly could occur as well.
All right. We sort of blew through the bottom of the hour break because we were putting the Surgeon General on. So we're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be back with our conversation about the very serious problem of opioid addiction in Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org, where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are going to go back to the phones. We've got calls stacked up here. Jeremy is in Minto. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
Did you have a question for our doctors in studio?
Yeah, actually, like she said, I'm from Minto, and we're on a road system. We're a small village on the road system. And there's a lot of young people that live in Fairbanks, you know, and a lot of young people from other villages on road systems that live in Fairbanks. And I start noticing that some of them are starting to get into heroin and whatnot. And now they haven't brought it into the village, but I'd like to know if there's any type of program or, you know, some type of funding that we could use to start educating our people about the dangers of opioid addiction and whatnot. And that's just one of my concerns, is about it coming into the village, because we start seeing on the road system a lot of other drugs coming in, you know, most notably methamphetamines, which, God bless, hasn't happened around here, but it's something that we really need to start looking at. And just to add on to that question, I was wondering if there's any kind of plan in place to help health aid, community health aid providers, to recognize ODs for what they are, and if they'll be given that naloxone or whatever it's called to use. That's pretty much the only questions I have.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. You raised some excellent points about the concern in rural communities on the road system, where there's traffic that can come from larger urban areas into these smaller communities. And then the problem of our health aides being trained and given the tools that they need to help people in the villages. Dr. Butler.
Well, I think Jeremy raises an excellent point, because no matter what level of prevention we're talking about, the foundation is education and information, whether that's public education or professional education. As the Surgeon General pointed out, one of the things that's unique about the opioid crisis is that the healthcare providers have unfortunately helped contribute to the problem in terms of how we have been trained to administer opioids over the past 20 years. It's not unlike, I think, some of the challenges we've had with antimicrobial drugs and the emergence of drug-resistant bacteria. In terms of specific questions about funding, I'll also return to the Surgeon General's comment about the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, CARA, which has been signed into law. It provides a lot of authority for the government to do things, including potentially funding programs, but it does still need the appropriation to make the funding happen. In terms of specific training for community health aides, maybe I'll defer to Dr. Coleman
Dr.
on
Coleman.
That question.
Yes, please, Dr. Coleman.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, and I'll just second that, you know, as a healthcare organization, we watch grants that come through quite frequently, both at the federal, state level. And I can say that there is support for thinking about how we get addiction services out to rural areas, specifically even. We have a grant or two that's specifically for that area. I'm sure other regional healthcare organizations that help care for our rural communities also are receiving these same funds. And I don't know of any specifics that target the health aides per se, but I can tell you that they're conscious and everybody is thinking about how to do this from a healthcare or a system-wide perspective, both community and behavioral health aides, thinking about getting them CDCs, which is chemical dependency specific training of sorts, has been a topic that people have been discussing. And then also looking at, again, how do we get both mental health and addiction services out to the kind of primary care infrastructure that already exists in the state, again, through the health aides or local clinics, hub communities, things of that nature. And so we're, for instance, very soon going to be trying out, kind of experimenting with a model of how we can support our primary care providers in providing both medication-assisted treatment and then also our behavioral health consultants in being present to help address addiction from a mental health standpoint as well. And I think it's, you know, I'll just say I think it's really important to try to take both of those angles. That is, you know, it's great to involve primary care and kind of increase the mental health capacity at the same time. It's really what's needed, I think, to help people establish good services.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about what the best path forward is and what hope there is for good treatment protocols as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're going to go quickly to the phones. Christy is in Homer. Hi, Christy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate this subject because I have an adult child who's been fighting addiction for like over 10 years.
Mm. And so sorry.
We've done so many things, you know, and nothing has worked. And part of it is like your guests have said, part of it is that, you know, at a certain point they have no choice. You know, that's the only thing that they think about. My child has had stints where they have been incarcerated and haven't been had access to the drug for, you know, 10 months. And as soon as they're out, that's the first thing that they go and do.
Hmm.
So I guess my point that I'm trying to make is that none of the rehabilitation efforts have worked for her. And so I'm wondering if, you know, we should just start shifting our perspective on how we look at treating this illness completely, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I've heard that there are other alternatives, I've heard that acupuncture treatment can work. This is something that I actually tried to set up for my child, but, you know, because addiction is such a, it just grabs you so hard. Even the thought of being cured of that addiction, sometimes they don't want it. You know, they want to stay, or they don't, but they are a slave to this drug.
Well, Christy, I'm very sorry that you have this terrible struggle within your family. Thank you so much for sharing what is clearly a very painful story with us. And we only have a couple minutes left. Let's give Dr. Butler and Dr. Coleman a chance to help us end on a more positive note with what is the best practices available now? What's happening in treatment?
Well, let me just start by saying thank you, Christy, for sharing your story. You are not alone, but oftentimes we suffer in silence, whether we are addicted or we love someone who is addicted. Nationally, 1 in 12 Americans report that they either know someone or have someone in their family who not only has struggled with addiction, but has actually experienced an overdose. So the situation you're describing is far too common. I think you also highlight the fact there is no one magic bullet, that there are certain therapies that seem to work well for some people, other people not so much. And it's probably worth pointing out that some therapies work at one point in a person's life and not in another point in life. It is a chronic condition that oftentimes can lead to relapse unless it's continued to recognize as a condition that can require literally years for that relearning to occur and the changes in the brain to occur. I think one of the things I really want to highlight, not just for people who have addiction in their families, but also to my fellow healthcare providers, is we have to see the faces of recovery. And I think that's particularly important for providers who mainly see the active users because of the medical complications that occur because of the use. And I think one of the really positive aspects of the summit in Palmer on Thursday is it will be an opportunity for people to hear the stories of people who've been through addiction and now are in recovery. And those faces of recovery are something that help get me out of bed every morning and remind me of why I do the job I do.
Dr. Coleman, in the final minute, best practices from your perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that I think I've already seen some really good movement, you know, federally and in our country as a whole. The fact that it's this epidemic is now known and being talked about, that monies are being dedicated to help change systems, to help treat it. I think we still have a long ways to go, but I think that those are some of the next steps, that is continue with the education, continue talking about the issues, what's working, what's not, continue thinking absolutely about how we view addiction, not only in mental health, but in primary care as well, which is where a lot of the people are at right now with regard to identifying and treating this. And so I think we've made some positive changes and are headed in a good direction.
Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to all the callers. I'm sorry that we could not get to everyone who called in today. Thank you to Dr. Jay Butler, Chief Medical Officer in Alaska, and Dr. Shane Coleman, Doctor of Psychiatry.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at AlaskaCleanHarbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.